Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're watching New York One. This is Decision 2013. Tonight, a Democratic debate for comptroller under the auspices of the New York City Campaign Finance Board. And now, from the CUNY TV studios before a live studio audience, here is New York One political anchor, Errol Lewis.
Good evening. Welcome to the first live Democratic primary debate in the race for city controller. I'm Errol Lewis, and I'm joined in tonight's debate at the CUNY TV studios by Brian Lehrer, the host of WNYC's Brian Lehrer Show. The next 60 minutes will be an uninterrupted conversation about issues where you'll get a chance to learn more about the two Democratic candidates seeking to become our city's next controller. The controller is the city's chief fiscal officer who oversees the more than $130 billion invested in the city's pension funds. The controller also reviews and certifies government contracts and audits city agencies to ensure that dollars are being spent wisely and that agency goals are being met. Tonight's debate is part of the official NYC Votes debate program for the 2013 elections administered by the New York City Campaign Finance Board. The board manages our city's public matching funds program, which is designed to strengthen the role of average New Yorkers who make small dollar contributions to candidates. The CFB also selects partners to bring the debates to New Yorkers. Tonight's debate is sponsored by New York One News, New York One Noticias, the Citizens Union of the City of New York, the Hispanic Federation, the Citizens Committee for New York City, Gothamist, Transportation Alternatives, WNYC, and Time Warner Cable. And so without further ado, let's introduce the two candidates, Scott Stringer and Elliot Spitzer. The candidates will have 1 minute to respond to questions that are asked to them. They'll also be given the opportunity to respond if they are addressed directly by the opponent. We're also going to have what we call a cross-examination, where each candidate will be able to ask his opponent a question. There will also be a lightning round in the middle of the debate, in which candidates will only be allowed to give a one-word answer, usually yes or no, to each question. So we are ready to begin. And by the flip of a coin, we've determined that Scott Stringer will get the first question.
First, though, one additional note. As you watch or listen to this debate tonight, you can react in a live online chat. To participate, go to the website of any debate sponsor, including NewYorkOne.com, that's NY1.com, or WNYC.org. Mr. Stringer, a federal judge today, as I'm sure you know, ruled that the city's stop-and-frisk policies are unconstitutional and appointed a federal monitor to oversee the NYPD in this respect. The city also pays out a great deal of money every year in lawsuit damages from suits against the NYPD. Do you think that the controller has any role in overseeing NYPD policies, and would you be active in that if you're elected?
Well, first, let me thank the Campaign Finance Board and all the sponsoring organizations for giving Elliot and I an opportunity to talk about the issues as it relates to the controller's race. I'm very happy to be here. I think today was a very significant ruling, and I praise the judge. It's clearly wrong when we stop 700,000 young people of color for walking down the street, going to the store, buying a quart of milk. Grandmothers and parents have been concerned about this for so long, and I have been one of the critics of stop, question, and frisk. So hopefully a new day is coming to this city. The controller actually can play an important role as it relates to claims and adjustments. Controller settles claims, and right now, if you look at fiscal year 17, it's estimated that we will have to pay out some $800 million in claims. Some of that is Health and Hospitals Corporation. Other has to do with the NYPD. I think we should model the work of the controller after what other cities are doing, like L.A. and Portland, making sure that we target and analyze where the police complaints are coming from so that we can work with the NYPD to reduce the claims and also raise issues relating to people who are making claims against the police. This is costing the city money, money that can go for schools and for daycare centers, and it's not right. So I'm going to use the office, the Bureau of Claims and Adjustments, to focus on this issue, reduce the claims, but also do the kind of analysis that's necessary so that we can reduce police actions, and hopefully stop and frisk. The court decision today will go a long way to helping us equal the playing field in this city.
Thank you, Mr. Spitzer.
Well, look, back in 1999 when I was Attorney General, I investigated this issue. In fact, the report we put out then, the investigation we did, is still, until today's decision by the court, the seminal document that said this was a major issue. We needed to confront it. And I would make this observation. Of course, the controller needs to be a participant, as I was as Attorney General, in ensuring that claims against the state were properly litigated, settled, and handled. But the larger issue is one that the police department has failed to respond properly. And much as we applaud, and indeed we need to live in a city that is safe, the violations of the Constitution that were highlighted in today's decision by Judge Scheinlin do not, in fact, make us safer. They make us less safe. And part of the reason we have had this problem continuing for the past couple years is that we've had a third term with a mayor whose police department has refused to participate with the judge when the judge said, give us answers, explain to us how to bring stop and frisk within the constitutional boundaries. Stop and frisk will continue, but it's got to be changed. The reason we had a third term is because the political establishment, with Scott's support and participation, gave the mayor a third term, and that is why on issue after issue, whether it's midtown zoning or failing education numbers, we've had a third term where we've had a mayor who was not responsive. Stop and frisk is part of it. We need to change that policy and do it now.
And Mr. Stringer, you'll get your rebuttal in a second. But I just want to follow up because that answer sounded like a policy statement on stop and frisk. Could you say what role the controller's office would play and you as controller in this if you're elected?
Precisely what I did as Attorney General with respect to all the claims brought against the state of New York, where we litigated them properly, aggressively, settled when appropriate. The controller weighs in on those settlements, has the final say on those settlements. We understood those litigations. As Attorney General, that was my job. That's why we looked at this issue along with all the issues that confronted the state in terms of malpractice claims, in terms of false imprisonment claims. We understood the constitutional issues. We understood the policy issues. That's why in 1999, I investigated this issue. Light years before others were focusing on it, we took an issue that was at that point only experiential and documented. We studied every UF 250 and said, here is the magnitude of the problem. Still to this day, the single best report on the issue.
UF 250 is the forms that the officers fill out when they stop somebody.
Correct.
Mr. Stringer.
Well, trying to get back to what your question actually was, there are 18 bureaus in the controller's office. And in the claims department, we continue to see outrageous claims against the city for the tune of $800 million, between $600 million and $800 million a year. What I want to do with the claims department is very simple. I want to do what they did in L.A., where they looked at different police precincts and figured out where the police complaints were coming from, and then worked to mitigate those complaints by putting in risk management so that we can actually save money for the city. Look, it's well known. I've been one of the leaders in trying to mend and end stop and frisk. I was one of the first elected officials who looked like me, who organized a coalition of people around the city to say we can do better. But I didn't just say end it and mend it. What I said was, we have to look at different ways to bring people together. We can't have young people alienated from the police department. So we have to look at other cities, like in Boston, where they're actually working with gang members and others, with clergy, to figure out ways to get our kids into real jobs and real programs. That's how you're going to make the city better. That's how you're going to reduce unemployment, by getting kids involved so that they don't get into harm's way. That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. Next question is going to be first for you, Mr. Spitzer. Many people don't know what the controller actually does. So tell us in broadest but succinct terms, why does this office matter? Why does this election matter?
Look, this is an enormously significant position where not only, I think everybody understands, you oversee the pension funds. I think you understated, you said 130. It's actually about $137 billion. That money has to be there for those who've paid into the pension system so they get their pensions when they deserve to get them. You need to oversee an enormous investment in our capital markets, which means understanding the capital markets, investing wisely, saving, I would hope, over $400 million in fees right now that we're paying unnecessarily. Study just came out showing an inverse correlation between fees paid and return. So part one, use that pension fund to invest it wisely and use it as a vehicle for change, something we could talk about at great length, investing in our communities, the infrastructure, and using it to speak to corporate America that needs to be reformed. Second, you do audits. Audits meaning not just are the paperclips delivered when a contract has been issued, but is the policy we've put in place, the policy we're paying for, the educational system, where we just saw numbers going off the cliff this past week, what is the outcome of the dollar spent? You give significant and important policy recommendations with respect to the urban policies that guide our city, how to invest, zoning, for instance, where my opponent has signed on to a misguided rezoning policy for Midtown, which was rammed through at the end of this mayor's third term. Policy audits being the second major bucket, the third being oversight of the city budget itself to make sure it's in balance and to make sure that, in fact, the revenues we need in the out years are there to cover the expenses that we're incurring based upon the contracts that are let. An enormously important issue because right now, for 4 years, we've had municipal employees without a contract. Why? Because a mayor given a third term, again by my opponent, didn't feel any need to negotiate. We're now going to have an enormous hit to the budget in the out years where we will have to make up for that. So this is a critically important role. I could go on. I know that my time is probably winding down, but so many things you can do. You can do with that office what I did to the Attorney General's office, reimagine it, reinvigorate it, turn it into a national leader on urban policy, pension investing, using the money that is our money, not just to count it, to make sure it counts.
Thank you. Mr. Stringer.
I believe a controller is the job that supports the middle class, the people who aspire to it, and the people who are struggling in this city. Let's face it, so many of us are getting priced out. People can't afford the rent. They can't make their mortgage payments. As controller, I want to be the one who's going to go through the books, root out waste, and then use that savings to build the next generation of affordable housing, making sure that we can provide quality education for our kids. And we've got to start thinking about middle-class tax cuts so we can relieve people of the burden they're facing every day. There's a sense in the city that City Hall's not listening. And we've got to take this office and watch out for the backs of the little person, the person who struggles every day. Now, look, the biggest part of this job is trust, because you're a fiduciary of a $140 billion pension fund. And I don't think that it's right that the person who runs for this office should be somebody who has engaged in money laundering, somebody who has used his previous offices and used it in a way that suggests illegal activity, both as attorney general and as governor. We've got to have the kind of trust and fiduciary responsibility that will give investors the sense that New York has the highest level of integrity. And in every job he's had in government, he was engaged in money laundering, illegal wire transfers. This is not the kind of controller that will give confidence to our pension fund. So before we get into the issues of what we'd like to do with the job, we have to look at how we're going to comport ourselves as elected officials.
You know, I just feel compelled to say that my opponent here throws terms around. He's involved in ad hominem attacks because he doesn't have a career record he can run upon. So he has waged a relentless personal attack.
You just don't know right from wrong.
Mr. Stringer, I respect your opportunity to talk.
Tell the truth.
Mr. Stringer, you're throwing terms around which you do not understand or where you misstate the facts. And I think you should be better than that. And this campaign should be better than that. Talk about protecting the middle class. When I stood up for the middle class, which was harmed to the tune of $14 trillion by an economic crisis that evolved in 2008 and thereafter, it evolved and was the result of Wall Street practices that some of us had been confronting for many years, while my opponent sat on his hands. Some of us stood up to the establishment and said, we are seeing structural failures in our capital markets that will do enormous harm to the middle class. The middle class needs to be protected. That's what I was doing. That's why the middle class, whether it's through mutual fund investments or their pension fund investments, when I was speaking to Wall Street saying, you are not running the capital markets with integrity, the middle class was who I was thinking about. And indeed, case after case where I had to stand alone because of the political establishment and the Wall Street establishment that is funding your campaign through independent expenditures, when they were sitting there and you were receiving their contributions, some of us were standing up for the middle class. That is why the middle class trusts me to guard their pensions and to invest their funds.
Elliot, I respectfully disagree with you. They don't trust you because you let them down. Even if what you're saying is true, that somehow you could foresee the financial calamity, which is, I would say, a stretch at best. When you became governor, you didn't protect the people from the calamity. You resigned in disgrace. You didn't meet your fiduciary responsibilities. And then you left Governor Patterson with a $23 billion deficit. Governor Cuomo had to come in and rework the legislature and get us out of this fiscal mess. So you talk a good game fighting for the middle class, but when it was on your watch, when you had an opportunity to make a difference for all the people who were holding those mortgages, for the people who were trying to struggle to put food on the table in one of the greatest fiscal calamities of our generation, you dropped the ball and you had to leave. And you had to leave, and I'll tell you why you had to leave. Because you left because you were in a federal investigation, because you laundered money. And that's the truth. And the reason you laundered money was because you were trying to manipulate the banking laws so people wouldn't uncover your activity. Now, that's painful, and we don't have to belabor that for you. But to suggest that in some way during this time period, your dysfunction in Albany, your governorship, was somehow helping the middle class, Let me tell you what I was doing while you were resigning. I was building out 3 university expansions. It's going to create 10,000 to 40,000 jobs in the next 30 years. I was fighting for tenants in NYCHA housing. I was able to help direct $500 million in stimulus money to make repairs of elevators. While you were in hiding after you resigned, I was working with a coalition of folks to deal with issues of stop and frisk, to make sure that we were in communities organizing people. That's the difference between us. Rhetoric and talk is cheap. When you had an opportunity, you abdicated your responsibility.
You know, Scott, with all due respect. With all due respect, that's right. We are waging a respectful campaign,
always,
despite all the ad hominem attacks you're throwing at me. Let me remind you of what the New York Times editorial board said repeatedly about my tenure as governor, when they said that I was doing the right and brave thing, standing up for immigrants, standing up for low-wage workers, that I was bringing fundamental change to Albany because of the budget that we passed in 07 that did something critically important that had not happened in the 12 years you were there in the Assembly, the most dysfunctional legislature in the nation, according to the Brennan Institution. We fully funded education in the city of New York to the tune of $1.76 billion. That we did. We redirected health care. And the New York Times editorial page said, and I won't get the words precisely right, but we'll post it on my website, I fearlessly took on 2 of the toughest issues in Wall Street, financing education and reining in health care. That is what we were doing. We were changing the structure of state government so that the middle class of this state would, in fact, be able to the beneficiary.
Let me just say this. So let's talk about all the editorials. So when I was in Albany, the New York Times called me someone who had a sterling reputation for reform, and I was a catalyst for ending empty seat voting and making real reform. The New York Times, in describing your governorship, talked about you as a colossal failure. So they endorsed me for borough president, talked about the real work I did reforming Albany. You had an opportunity to make the same case to the New York Times, and they were disappointed and called you a failure. So which editorial are we going to talk about tonight?
Empty seat failure being the process of your legislature just to vote without there being a... So this is the fundamental reform
no,
that you're
And when you came to Albany, we thought that you would take it to the next level, and you failed.
We're gonna get this back on track. We are enjoying the conversation, and it has been enlightening, but we also had a lot of questions that were brought to us by our audiences, and we want to make sure those questions get asked, too. Let's go to Brian.
And getting back to the difference that the job of controller can make in people's lives, Mr. Stringer, your opponent has cited former controller Elizabeth Holtzman as a role model. And I wonder if you have a role model among past controllers for how they made a difference in people's lives and how you would follow in those footsteps.
Well, I'm proud to have the support of Controller Thompson and Controller Holtzman, who he admires, as well as Controller Golden, Controller DiNapoli. They all cite my experience, my even-headedness, my ability to work with people in coalition. But the controller that I look to is Controller Golden, and I'll tell you why. They all did a great job. But the reason I look at Golden is because that was the time of this fiscal crisis, when the city was on the edge of bankruptcy. And there was real sense that we couldn't bring people together. We didn't have the ability to look at how to get out of this fiscal crisis. And Golden and you, Carrie, and all the people involved in finance and real estate and our labor unions came together. And that was sort of the beginning of the modern controller's office. That's when the controller started working on corporate governance issues, making alliances around the country to leverage our pension fund for making our pension investments better. And I think he played a major role. But Liz Holtzman was also somebody, I agree with Elliot, who looked at public policy as a legitimate avenue for the controller, which is why my 50 reports on rooting out government waste and standing up for the people in the city will be very relevant when I'm controller.
So are these the same kinds of things that you both stand for, that you both look to your predecessors for, or different?
Well, let me put it this way, Brian. I think we can all invoke the same principles of a controller doing policy audits. The question is who has actually taken an office in government and reinvigorated it in a way that stands for the change, standing up for the establishment, standing up for the independence that is critical in this job. And I would suggest if you look at what I did as Attorney General for the 8 years, where I could have joined the Attorney General's office and gone in and said, yes, all my predecessors did nice, lovely jobs, but I understood there was so much more we could do. That is what I'll do with the controller's office. It is a question of leveraging the $140 billion of our money, not their money, our money into corporate reform so we can protect the middle class by ensuring there isn't another economic cataclysm, by bringing into the office, electing somebody to the office who understands the capital markets, who doesn't need to learn on the job in terms of that critical central issue, who knows how to conduct audits, who knows how not just to find the waste, but speak to the issues of governance and reform and education policy that are critical to this job. That is what I will do. That is what I have done. Look at the Attorney General's office in my tenure as the model. Look at what I did as governor, reforming health care, reforming education finance, bringing to New York City for the first time what it was due. To talk in the lexicon of Albany, we broke shares, the antiquated system that had survived all of Scott's tenure there, during which New York City was shortchanged billions of dollars that mothers and kids and teachers did not have to put into our educational system. That is the reform I'm talking about. That is what I've done. That's what I believe in.
I wish it was so easy, Elliot. The truth is that while you talk about the education money that you were able to allocate, you also proposed cutting revenue sharing by $327 million to our city. When those of us were saying you to bring back the commuter tax money that we lost as a city, $5 billion over the last 10 years, you wouldn't sign on and say that people in Long Island and the suburbs should pay a little bit for our services, police and fire. You sided with the people in the suburbs, not the people in the city. To suggest that you actually were able to bring money here, you took money with the other hand. Listen, the job of controller is to work with people, to audit city agencies, to find waste, to move money to doing real good work for the city, whether it's education, housing, health care. These are the challenges as the controller. I've done this for the last 7.5 years. As borough president, I took on the lonely struggle to help the tenants at NYCHA Housing. I went through 3,710 elevator inspection reports. We found that those elevators fail 75% of the time. But we didn't just do a report. We actually went to work with Senator Schumer, with NYCHA, and we were able to appropriate $500 million to start fixing the elevators. I came up with the idea to change the patronage governance structure. And you know what happened? I went to Albany, and I got it done this year. See, this job is not being the Lone Ranger or the sheriff. It's about building those coalitions. It's about working in Albany and in the city on behalf of the city. You have not been doing that as governor and as attorney general. The truth is, it was all about being the sheriff, the lone guy, the outlier. This job is a little bit different. You have to be independent. You have to take the tough fights to the people. You have to be able to challenge the mayor and say that $1 billion in outside consultants that are being paid out of DOE, that money is not going to the classroom. So then you have to stand up. But it's not just calling it out. You have to find a way to get results. Every report I've issued, every fight I've waged, behind it has been a result. And that's what the controller's supposed to do.
Okay, but
you're supposed to be able to work with people to get that result. Otherwise, all this office is another soapbox. And we've had enough of soapboxes.
Look, for first, the controller needs to be able to do some math, arithmetic, let's call it. $1.76 billion incrementally in education. Yes, we cut a deal. It's not always easy. We made a deal.
Minus $5 billion is a negative.
No.
One at a time.
Negative, please.
Minus $300 million that you did. We're still $1.4 billion ahead in the city. That was precisely the deal we cut. And breaking shares meant over the tenure of this deal, over the next 10 years, the city was going to pick up many, many billions of dollars. It was an exquisite deal for the city. You're right. You need to work with other people. I did. We passed this budget. There are times, however, when there's nobody else to work with. That was the case when it came to protecting immigrants and driver's licenses, which is why the New York Times said I was fearless in taking on that fight, why we got fundamental change in the budget, which is why they gave me enormous plaudits for changing the fundamental principles of healthcare finance and education finance. Sometimes you have to be willing to stand up alone, and that is the difference between us. Sometimes you need to be independent, have the fortitude, be willing to stand up to an establishment that has given you an embrace to the tune of millions of dollars in independent expenditures they plan to spend for you, because those at the very top of our political and Wall Street establishment do not want an independent voice as controller.
No, I think the difference is a lot of people don't want recklessness. Here's the real facts. As borough president, the issues that I've worked on were about making sure that immigration officials at ICE, immigration officials were not in Rikers Island going after innocent people. Your driver's license idea was a great idea and it was a great press release. But you dropped it because you couldn't take the heat in Albany. You actually couldn't get it done. And that's the difference here. When I put out an issue, I got the issue passed by the city council. I work with immigration advocates. I worked with elected officials, Latino elected officials, who said we can make a difference here. You didn't work with anybody. You put an idea out for your own political viability to cover up other things that were going on, like Troopergate. You know this. You didn't really want to get it done, and you didn't get it done. We in the city, however, have actually made great strides fighting for the DREAM Act, fighting at Rikers Island to try to give innocent people hope in this city.
And let me jump in just so we can go on to some of the other topics. But Mr. Spitzer, since he went first, you'll get one last 15-second rebuttal on this.
I think we just need to go back to the record. The idea of driver's licenses, we had an enormous and very powerful group supporting it. It was a great idea then. It has become the law of the nation, the law of many, many states. We fought the tough battle. You're right. We couldn't get it through at that moment, Scott, because many people, including you, ran for the hills when it was the moment to stand up and be tough.
You dropped it. Elliot dropped it when you had no more use for it.
With all due respect, please let me finish. People who should have been there to support it, including the mayor, who you've given a third term, ran away from it.
And we'll come
back to
these
issues later on. If you had the fortitude to be there, it would have happened.
Errol? Okay, I've got a question for you, Mr. Spitzer. How political should a controller be? You have talked about using the power of the office to pursue agendas, and you cite the battle against apartheid back in the 1980s as an example. But where would you draw the line if elected, and by what process would you select political priorities as city controller?
First of all, you shouldn't be political, in particular when it comes to the pension funds. Politics is not where or how one invests. One invests with caution to get returns, but also based upon principles of integrity and ethics. That's what good investing is all about. That's what I've done. That's what I stand for. Now, when you mentioned the apartheid, the effort, which was when I was in college, I was active in, people said to corporate America, you as corporate America should not be active in a regime, South Africa, based upon principles of apartheid. That was the right thing to do. It was not political, it was an ethical and a moral obligation. Yes, you fight those battles. But when I talk about using the pension fund in a more traditional context, it is to make sure that the companies that we own, and understand, we own them, and I've said over and over, ownership is more powerful than regulation. Ownership is more powerful than prosecution. Our money, through the shares we own, the proxy power we have, can do several things, many things. One, the easy thing, separate the role of CEO and board chair. That way you get greater oversight at the corporate level. You wouldn't have at J.P. Morgan Chase, the London Whale, manipulation of the energy markets over and over again where risk management has failed. These are the things we could do. This is being loyal to one's fiduciary obligation, understanding the capital markets, building coalitions, as I did as Attorney General, to get all 50 states to bring cases. You get all the pensions across the states to say, we want you, corporate America, to put people on your boards who have the skill set, who understand risk management, who do not believe in leverage ratios of 40 to 1. You need to be able to speak their language, look them in the eye, and say, we understand the capital markets and what you have done right and wrong. That is where a good and smart pension enforcer and owner steps into the fray. That is what I have done. That is what I will do. We need somebody right out of the gate who understands the capital markets. That's why I'm the candidate.
Mr. Stringer.
Well, I'm very proud of my role as on the NYSERS trustee, $45 billion fund. Every year, we engage in some 60 shareholder resolutions. We're constantly looking at ways to hold corporations accountable to performance, making sure that executive pay is tied to that performance. We're looking at ways to make sure corporations disclose political contributions. You know, Elliot's trying to buy this race. He's a self-funder. But we want to know where the corporations are spending the big money. So part of doing that is making sure that we build coalitions with other investment funds. We're the sixth largest investment fund in the country, 14th largest in the nation, and we do have a proud history in this NYSERS fund of making sure that we're engaged in issues like divestment, whether it's apartheid or more recently, the role I played in terms of gun divestment. These are the critical issues that the controller can play, but the difference is we also have to make sure that while we are doing this global corporate work, we have to make sure that these corporations are also providing good returns so that we hit our actuarial targets as a steward of the pension fund. So this is not our money. This is the money of 650,000 retirees, and you have to do this work carefully and substantively. And part of what you have to recognize is that even as powerful as $140 billion is, when you're looking at trying to change corporations, the big Fortune 500 companies, our investment, believe it or not, is relatively small. So it's incumbent upon us to work with CalPERS and Texas Teachers and CalSTRS and build that coalition. That's what I've been able to do in the Assembly, passing legislation, whether it's domestic violence or Albany reform. That's what I've been able to do as a borough president, holding agencies accountable but getting results. The same is true as our pension fund. Elliot's late to this. We've been working on these issues for the last 7.5 years. While he was in his ivory tower, we were actually doing this kind of work day in and day out. But you have to be careful, you have to be a fiduciary, and you always have to think first that you are actually managing someone else's money. someone else's retirement security. So you can't be a lone ranger. And that is something we always think about. And that's what I've done in the last 7.5 years.
A couple quick points. First, NYCHERS has failed. Let's be very blunt. Our pensions have failed in their effort to reform corporate governance. Corporate governance is a mess. It continues to be a mess. The coalitions that should have been formed have not been formed, Scott, despite your continuous
I'm not controlling it.
Scott, interrupting is not what we're supposed to be
doing.
I
just want to set the facts.
Scott, you'll have your chance.
Okay, keep going, Elliot. Keep going.
Thank you. NYCHERS has failed. Whatever claims there may be, corporate governance continues to be a failure, a mess. Shareholders are not flexing their powers. When I was Attorney General, I did, in fact, look at the cases, the mutual fund cases, which drove down, saved investors tens, hundreds of billions of dollars. The insurance cases, the analyst cases, discussed once again on the front page of today's New York Times business section. Those are the cases that mattered. We did it. Second, I would say that we are not hitting our targets. NYCHERS is not hitting its target. And in fact, the pension funds have been underperforming. Hence, we have this enormous chasm down the road that will have to be funded. And third, you say repeatedly, I'm trying to buy this election, Scott. I'm just trying to keep up with you, keep up with the money you're going to spend and all the millions of dollars that your allies on Wall Street and in the political plutocracy have said they're going to spend. The moment I got in, they formed independent expenditures. They said, we're going to spend millions of dollars because they, from Wall Street to the corporate boardroom, don't want an independent voice. That's precisely why the middle class should want me. Just as I was there for the 8 years as Attorney General, standing up to Wall Street, when nobody was there to join me in that battle, I will do the same thing as controller.
Quick response, if you'd like. Other than that, we'll move on.
No, I'd be happy to respond. The truth of the matter is that you are someone who's not participating in the campaign finance program. You're acting like a Republican, not a Democrat. You'd say that everyone else should participate in the program, but you won't do it. You don't want a level playing field because you want to self-fund. You're the biggest real estate donor to yourself. And the truth of the matter is, I have 4,000 donors from all over the city. People give $50, $25. You won't even take a contribution for somebody of $10. You are trying to destroy one of the best campaign finance systems in the country. And quite frankly, it's a tribute to the campaign finance board that they have you here in spite of the fact that you have violated the integrity of this system.
Okay,
but you're not gonna but I'm not done.
Continue. Go ahead.
Thank you.
We got another 25 minutes.
Well, you know, you're interrupting me, so you should just relax.
I'm just asking you to continue.
So I'm going to.
I gathered that.
The reality is that your campaign is about coming in and trying to buy an election, and that is not what's going to happen in this city. I believe very strongly in the integrity of campaign finance. It's the essence of how we're going to straighten out Washington, straighten out the state, and also support a system that really works.
You know, look, Scott, you ran for mayor for 3 years. You raised money from all the special interest groups for 3 years. Then when that campaign didn't even register in the polls, your name didn't even register, you said, I'll run for controller. You cut more backroom deals to squeeze other candidates out. And then you said, now that I've raised all this money from the special interests, I can participate in the public financing system. I got into this race July 7. I didn't have time to raise money. I believe in competition, something that you clearly didn't want, which is why you'd cut backroom deals to get everybody else out of this race. Competition is good, whether in the marketplace for products or in politics. It gives the voters a choice, gives them a chance to say whose record is better, who's going to be independent. I didn't take money from special interests. My money is my own, and that is what the public knows.
And that's the problem with this country right now. People like yourself can buy the next toy, the next office, without having to go out and have living room conversations, talk to the middle class, and earn their support. You can come in and go right to television. You spent more money on television than I think all the mayoral candidates combined because you don't have to participate in a level playing field. And here's the other thing that I think you're missing. The reality is you have supported, when you were governor, the same people, the same special interests that you're trying to tag me with, they gave you tons more money than they could ever give someone who's running for city office. You took money from real estate, from the insurance companies, because they wanted your favor in Albany. All the special interest people supported you. And the reason they're not supporting you today, is because you failed the state. Now let's talk about who the special interests who were supporting me. The National Abortion Rights Action League, now New York City, Planned Parenthood. They're supporting me because of my work on domestic violence. And they're disappointed with you as the way you've comported yourself as governor. Those are the people, like Senator Gillibrand, who support me.
We're going to leave that point for now. I imagine you might want to come back to it later in the debate. But right now, we're going to do what we call the cross-examination, and we'll allow you, Mr. Spitzer, to ask a question of Mr. Stringer.
Scott, you were part of the backroom cabal that gave Mike Bloomberg a third term, directly contrary to the wishes of the public that had voted twice to say we believe in term limits. As a consequence of that, even today we saw the police department not participating, giving Judge Scheindlin ideas about how to remedy stop and frisk. We've seen education numbers that have gone over a cliff in terms of performance. We have seen unions working without a contract for 4 years. We've seen a midtown zoning proposal that is being rammed through right now. Do you regret voting against the public twice on this critical issue?
Well, you're exaggerating as usual because you're trying to make a point because you haven't been part of the civic conversation for 5 years and now you've swooped in trying to, you know, hit your poll data. But here's the facts. I've never supported term limits. I think elections are about democracy. I like the fact that we could have a campaign finance system to encourage more people to run. Voters should decide who's elected. Now, sometimes I do worry that when you have a large change in government, it gets to be a little chaotic. When you imposed term limits on yourself and you resigned, well, there was chaos and it was chaotic and a lot of people got hurt. People in our city struggled because of the budget deficit that you left us, because you left in the middle and you left in a hurry. And I do worry about those issues. And I think it's something that you should worry about. The second thing is nobody worked harder to stop Bloomberg's third term than me. I walked the streets with Billy Thompson. We went to the senior centers. We did the kind of work necessary. You were nowhere to be found. Truth of the matter is, we don't really know what your real position here is because you never made a public statement. You never came out. You never wrote a check. A small check that's matched 6-1, by the way. They're matched. And so you never participated. But now you come in to try to suggest that in some way you were part of all of this. You were sidelined. Now, part of the reason why you were sidelined is because you left under a federal investigation. I understand that. But what you did is you didn't go to help the Democrats take back City Hall. You went to a TV studio where you were walled off from what was really going on in the streets of the city. You didn't walk Bed-Stuy. You didn't walk Staten Island. In fact, we were nowhere to be found after the hurricane. Here we were struggling to get food and blankets to people in NYCHA housing, send supplies to Coney Island, go to Breezy Point. And what were you saying on that TV show that you got $2 million for? You were criticizing us as we were in the streets. You were telling us we weren't doing enough. But you didn't get your hands dirty. And you're not getting your hands dirty now. And you haven't been there in the last 5 years.
You know, Scott, I got my hands dirty for 10 years as Attorney General, as Governor, changing
that you
Albany.
Did. That you
changing
did.
Changing Albany.
That's true.
We changed the education budget of the city of New York. We reformed health care. We transformed Wall Street. We took on the tough battles. You sat on your hands and played nice with the establishment, the same establishment that is contributing millions of dollars for independent expenditures for you. I am merely trying to get my voice heard. Yes, I've been out there on the streets every day, Scott. We have been in every borough repeatedly. And you know what I hear on the street? What I hear on the street is the people are looking at the totality of my record, and they're saying, we've all sinned. But you have made a difference. And you've made a difference to every one of us by taking on Wall Street, fighting for immigrants, fighting for low-wage workers, fighting for women's rights. And that is the type of fortitude, independence, and strength of will that they want in the controller of the
state. Your question, Mr. Stringer.
Oh, okay. So, Elliot, if you were the chairman of a large company and you hired a CEO and they engaged in money laundering, illegal wiring of funds to shell corporations, and if the CEO was under federal investigation, criminal investigation, and that CEO was fired, would you hire that CEO again?
You know, Scott, I resigned 5 years ago, took responsibility for what I did, and the public is now looking at the totality of my record, and they are saying, we want you to come back to fight for us. We want you to fight for us because you alone stood up when the chips were down. You alone stood up for undocumented workers and said you deserve to get a driver's license to participate in our economy. You alone stood up to Wall Street, the most powerful folks in our economy, in our nation, who today are contributing millions of dollars to you because we said if we do not remedy these problems, we will have an economic cataclysm. And indeed, we had it. $14 trillion is what we suffered through. That is what the Federal Reserve Bank calculated was the harm to our economy, our middle-class voters, households, because we destroyed the essence of the middle class, because people did not have the fortitude to stand up, but I did. So the folks in the street, the voters, the ones who will get to make this determination, not the special interests funding your campaign, the voters have said repeatedly, yes, we want you to come back because we can forgive for somebody who has made a difference in our lives, somebody who sinned but has fought to make a difference. In 10 years in government, Scott, yes, I made that difference.
So I guess you didn't answer the question.
So yes, I didn't answer the question.
So the question basically was, should somebody who engaged in illegal activity during their entire government career should be the fiduciary of a $140 billion pension fund. Should you, by virtue of your colossal failure as governor, get another chance? And my view is that conversation has long passed. It's time for a new generation, new generation of leaders. We're going to have a new mayor, new public advocate, new controller, new council speaker. We've been working on these issues. The candidates around the city from all different neighborhoods, they want to have a real conversation. They don't want a conversation about somebody who's buying up resources. They want to have somebody who's gone out the hard way, 4,000 donors, making it clear that we have a grassroots people's campaign.
Errol, can I just respond very, very briefly? Just to sort of demographic point. New generation, how old are you?
I look good.
You look good for your age. I'll give you that, but I hope I do too.
You do too.
How old are you?
You're not the prosecutor tonight.
We're basically the same.
Let's get to the issue.
Gentlemen, relax.
20 years in government that you've had. I've had 10. I think a new generation is not the issue.
We represent a new generation of leadership. Okay. The people who are supporting me are ready to have a role in this government, real Democrats.
Okay. Let's move on to our lightning round. That's where I'm going to ask you a series of questions. The candidates will be able to answer yes or no to each question. And I'll start with you, Mr. Spitzer. Do you pay your bills online?
No, I do not.
Mr. Stringer?
Yes.
Mr. Stringer, have you ever bounced a check?
Yes.
Mr. Spitzer?
No.
Mr. Spitzer, have you ridden a city bike?
No, I have not.
Mr. Stringer?
Ditto.
Okay. Mr. Stringer, does it make financial sense for the Staten Island Ferry to be free?
Yes.
Mr. Spitzer.
Public transportation should be subsidized.
For you, Mr. Spitzer, have you ever not tipped a waiter or a cab driver?
No.
Never.
Okay. And Mr. Stringer, have you ever gambled at a casino?
Yes.
Mr. Spitzer.
Oh, yes. And lost.
And Mr. Spitzer, is the city prepared for the next hurricane?
No, but we're making slow progress.
Mr. Stringer?
No, but we're actually doing the work on that. Thank you.
Mr. Stringer, do you support paid sick leave for all New York City businesses?
Yes, and I have, and I was out there working on these issues.
Mr. Spitzer, yes or no?
Yes.
Have you ever, Mr. Spitzer, voted for a Republican?
Yes.
Mr. Stringer?
No.
Mr. Stringer, is controller the most exciting job you think you'll ever have?
Yes.
Mr. Spitzer?
You know, I don't think you can answer that question. It's a very exciting job. I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Spitzer, did the city get a fair deal on the new Yankee Stadium?
No.
Mr. Stringer?
No.
And Mr. Stringer, have you had a cronut?
No.
Mr. Spitzer?
No.
All right, back to the regular questions. And Mr. Spitzer,
we got through it.
This one is for you, and it's kind of a follow-up. Because you're emphasizing your independence and embracing the Sheriff of Wall Street nickname you were given. But when you resigned as governor, the New York Times article on your tenure said, quote, he tended to speak loudly when he might better have listened, unquote. So did you learn any lessons from your experience as governor that would lead you to govern differently as controller?
The answer is, of course, but I would also observe that we listened very well. And what we had was a broken legislature that needed to be reformed. And in order to build that coalition, which is exactly what we were doing, I have made the fundamental decision, unlike others, and you can have a debate about strategy, that the way to succeed was to reclaim the state Senate. The way to reclaim the state Senate was to elect Democrats so we could, in fact, put in place the agenda that we wanted, from campaign finance reform to the investment in infrastructure. And we were not only listening, we were acting. And so I would say, yes, of course, many lessons. I would hope one learns lessons every day in every job from every experience. But I would also say that the agenda and the approach that we embraced, in fact, would have led and was leading to fundamental reform in due course. When it was broken halfway through, of course, we couldn't see it. But we were getting there, and the reform was on the way.
But to the point, was one of the lessons for you to work more collaboratively than you did in Albany when you referred to yourself as a steamroller?
No, that was not the way we really referred to ourselves or I to myself. We were working collaborative, but I'd give you an example. The selection of the controller when Alan Hevesy left office. We had a deal. We had a three-way agreement. Everybody publicly said this was the right way to do it. We put together a panel of experts who would make a recommendation to the state legislature. Then the state legislature backed out of that agreement. We not only listened, we forged the agreement, we got everybody to sign on, and then the legislature said no. The legislature was ridiculed by every editorial board in the state, the New York Times, the Daily News, the New York Post, all the upstate papers. So there are times when you listen, and even though you've listened and worked, then the other parties do not cooperate. That is the legislature that Scott was a member of, and he was trying to reform it. That's great. But yes, there are times to listen, there are times to have fortitude, there are times to stand up and be independent. Each of those has a place.
Thank you. And Mr. Stringer, for considering how this debate has gone so far and what you each both want to emphasize, it could be that one of the reasons to vote for Mr. Spitzer, at least this is what he's arguing, is the people spending money to defeat him. The Wall Street firms, the public employee unions are in a rare coalition to defeat him and elect you. But these may be the most important sectors for a comptroller to be independent from. So why shouldn't the voting public see Elliot Spitzer as their independent representative and you as too acceptable to these powerful interests?
For the reasons he just talked about, the Albany speak of making deals and holding people to their word about committees and all that, I want to throw all that aside. The job of controller is to be a fierce advocate for the people, to be an independent fiduciary. $140 billion pension fund, you got to look out for the retirement security of people. But here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to get pension consolidation and reform because I'm going to work with the 58 trustees. I'm going to go back to Albany, where I was very successful passing legislation, and I'm going to get that done because I know how to work with people and I understand the buttons to push. You've got to be effective in this job. Anyone who knows me in my 20 years of public life, when I fought for university expansions, when I took on the tight fights for tenants, when I made it clear that we had to change Albany, and as an assembly member working with some of my progressive colleagues, we changed rules reform. We prepared for the moment that Elliot would come to Albany and build upon the reforms I started. That's why the Times called me a sterling catalyst for reform when I ran for borough president. And you know what happened? He had ideas, and he was even well-intentioned, but he couldn't work it. He couldn't get it done. And you have to work it in this job of controller. You have to have two distinct skill sets. You have to work with the mayor. You have to market bonds together. You have to go to the rating agencies together. You have to vouch for the integrity of the four-year financial plan. But at the same time, you also have to be fiercely independent. Take on City Hall. Look at the pressure points, how you can impact change. How can we make sure that we restore the cuts to the budget that are so fundamental to the people in the city?
Right.
I have worked on 20 budgets in my 20 years.
I want to keep this round tight so that we can get to a very important pension question from Errol next. But just a 30-second rebuttal, really 30 seconds from each of you, Mr. Spitzer.
Well, I would merely observe that Mr. Stringer observed he's been in Albany and 12 years in Albany, 8 years as borough president for 20 years. I wanted to ask, what mark has he left on public policy? Why is it that he needs to launch a campaign that is one of ad hominem attacks? Because the public doesn't know what, if anything, he's done. 10 years I was in government as Attorney General and Governor. The public knows that I fought independently, to come to your point, Brian, about the independence of this office, to stand up in the single arena that matters most for the controller, the capital markets, to protect their investments, their pensions, their mortgages.
All right.
That is where I stood up and was independent. That's what this job is all about.
30 seconds, Mr. Stringer.
No, the only reason why he served for 10 years and not 18 years is because he resigned in disgrace under a federal criminal investigation. The reality is that I have been somebody who's been a reformer who's actually gotten results. I have challenged the status quo. Look at what I've talked about tonight. Three university expansions, taking on NYCHR, calling out outside consultants of the Department of Education, building a professional land use staff that actually stood up and said no to developments like Chelsea Markets, made Madison Square Garden go through a 10-year permit process so that we can build out our transportation network. I've led this city on transportation policy, on food policy, on thinking about the economy, how small business can market themselves internationally. We've rolled out policy reports in this campaign. The only thing you've rolled out in this campaign is bundles of money.
Thank you.
And that's the difference between us.
Okay. We're getting toward the end, so we're going to hold you a little more strictly to time. And I'd appreciate some straight attention to the question itself, not so much your opponent on this one. The city's pension funds, Mr. Stringer, have underperformed the state pension fund and the market as a whole. Why did that happen, and what steps would you take to improve returns?
Well, on the good side, we have seen 12.4% returns. We're behind the state. We're actually a little more conservative, less investment in some of the alternatives that would perhaps produce better returns. but we're also very aware of what risk is about. You know, as controller, you want to look at this, you want to look at the market in the long term, and you want to make sure that the first priority is protecting the retirement security of the people in the city. So I think that while my friend Tom DiNapoli is doing a great job, I think you were wrong. He actually turned out to be a great controller. He's a great fiduciary. And I hope that in our work that we can continue to see returns. Nothing is forever, however. A good year doesn't mean that it's going to be the same as next year. But by putting risk management protocols in place, by looking at alternative investments that can hit our actuarial targets, and at the same time, being a little prudent, being a little sure, given the volatility of the market today.
Well, you know, I think the interesting thing is, Errol, because your question is exactly right, Scott wants to have it both ways. He's been a trustee for many years. He wants to claim as though this is a badge of honor, but they've underperformed. He's been a trustee, but we still have the five pension funds, which is costing us $400 million a year in fees that go to political buddies, and yet he wants to claim that and then say he will reform it. The fact of the matter is somebody who understands capital management, somebody who understands how to handle these funds, would collapse those five funds into one, as the mayor proposed, as John Liu proposed, would get it done, would save. We don't need 58 trustees. We need many fewer. Somebody who understands private equity investing in the hedge fund world and the capital markets would manage to get us the returns we want. NYCHRS still, and the other pension funds still, have unrealistic targets. They have not met them. They will not meet them. That has been a failure. It's going to cost the city and the state huge sums of money down the road.
I just want to say this is the real difference between us. You can't take a sledgehammer to the 58 trustees. You can't get rid of them. In order to make reform, Elliot, you actually have to work with the trustees. You have to actually go to Albany and pass legislation. The Bloomberg Lou plan had a lot of merit to it, but there was no strategic way to get it done. And the difference between you and I is I'm already thinking about the strategic way. Thinking about how to talk to trustees, how to convince them that you can save $1 billion a year, money that can go into the pockets of working people in the city. I want to be laser focused in reducing the fees we pay to wealthy managers, $400 million. We should use the power of the fund and leverage it with other funds around the country to get better deals. And finally, we have to build out our asset management division. Other institutional investors are now recognizing that rather than turn over the portfolio to big money managers, we can actually build that out within our fund. So I think part of what the difference is, because this is about figuring out the differences between us, this is going to take a lot of work. The ability to figure out a strategy to save $1 billion, to save the city money so we can put it to work for our schools, for housing, to work with the next mayor. This is the kind of role that I want to play. I was good at it in Albany. I passed 37 pieces of legislation, areas in domestic violence. That's why women in the state are supporting me because of my work. I'm very proud of it. This is how the controller has to comport themselves. There's no end around it.
Look, the interesting thing is, Scott, you've been a trustee for 8 years and none of this has happened.
I'm not the controller.
When I was the attorney general, we addressed the fee scams in the mutual fund industry. We have saved investors tens of billions of dollars. We drove fees down. We did what people said was unthinkable and impossible. We turned the law in that area on its head. We brought the cases, found the violations of fiduciary duty, and have saved middle-class investors tens of billions of dollars. But we've done it.
Yes.
I've been there. I fought the battle. You've been the trustee for 8 years. None of it has happened.
You're not, but I don't mention it because this is fundamental. You've been a prosecutor with a badge. You're the controller. You got to get over all that. Now you have to actually work with people and pass legislation and come up with an ability to do that. And that's something you don't understand.
On a fiduciary question, Mr. Spitzer, you said in Friday's debate that there's no lesson for New York in Detroit's bankruptcy or Chicago's pension.
We're not Detroit. There's a lesson there. I said it was very clear. There's a lesson there, but we are not Detroit.
Considering New York's problems in the 1970s, what is the lesson and how did it affect what you do as controller?
What I said Friday, what I've said consistently, and what has been said in the editorial pages and op-ed pages of the New York Times as well, is that Detroit faced a convergence of several factors. One, the single most important sector and industry there, the auto sector, not only left Detroit, it left the United States. There was a flight of people from downtown Detroit to the suburbs. Tax base disappeared, and there was no alternative magnet for jobs that was created to bring back into downtown Detroit the people, the intellectual capital that drives urban growth. If you read Richard Florida's book, The Creative Class, you can understand how you create that environment. That is precisely why, when it comes to midtown zoning, Scott is completely wrong. We don't just need 80-story skyscrapers. We need an urban life at the street level. That is why the parts of the city that are growing right now, the Flatiron District, Soho, NoHo, Brooklyn, Queens, they are the magnets for people, intellectual capital. The lesson for us is we have to nurture new sectors, which is what we were doing when I was governor and attorney general. Be mindful of the fact that the financial services sector will not continue to be what it was once. John Sexton, president of NYU, uses a brilliant metaphor. It's not fire, it's not ice. It's not finance, insurance, real estate anymore that will drive the city. And it is intellectual, cultural, educational institutions. That is where urban growth will come from.
And before
that is what will draw the people.
That's where we will get.
Can I have some of that time back?
Yes.
So the lesson of Detroit is actually a powerful one. But we do see some good news here. Because of the city's financial crisis, we were able to put triggers in place so that we're constantly modifying our budget. We're looking at different hot points so that we know that we have to be in balance. I think that will serve the city well. The difference with Detroit is 700,000 people left Detroit, but 800,000 people are expected here in the next 20 years. But we do have warning signs. We have pension obligations of $8 billion now. It was $1.2 billion in 2001. We have health care costs that are expiring. So that's why it's important that we do have the mayor and the unions working together with collective bargaining. I'm going to be an honest arbiter of the city's finances. I'm going to work to make sure that we can shape agreements, because we're not going to be whole financially unless we get that done. So lastly, I would say that in terms of the new way we're going to grow our economy, we can't be Wall Street reliant anymore. We have to invest in high tech and make sure that our children are not just being taught to a test, but they're being taught to a job and a career. That's what I've worked on as borough president, on these kinds of economic issues, bringing out the ability to look at shared office space and more broadband, figuring out how we can use our transportation system to grow communities. That's what my community-based planning has been all about. You only read when it's done. You don't realize the years of work with our community boards to shape our city, and the controller will play a good role in that.
Okay, the tyranny of the clock has asserted itself. It is time for each of the candidates to give a closing statement. Scott Stringer, we begin with you.
Well, one, I want to thank the Campaign Finance Board for allowing me to participate in the program. Without the Campaign Finance Board, candidates of modest means could never run for high public office, and I thank you very much. But this election is really critical. It's a change election. The people in the middle class are struggling more than ever before. There are people I visit with who don't believe government and City Hall is listening to them. They want somebody who can go into neighborhoods and actually find the way to change things. As borough president, I've been very effective. Three university expansions, 40,000 jobs, taking on NYCHA housing, talking about ways we can grow our economy, whether it's high tech or investing in the food economy, making sure that we can build healthy communities. I'm proud of the fact that as borough president, I went into El Barrio in East Harlem, worked with the community, and now we've reduced asthma rates by 35%. This is what the controller should be doing. It's also about financial literacy, making sure that we work with families so when those children are born, they have a real shot to go to college. My wife and I have two little babies, 20 months old and 11 weeks old. And we worry about them the way every working parent does. And we've got to make sure that every kid gets a fair shot. I'm running for controller because I want to level the playing field. The rich shouldn't win every office. We need one standard of justice so that everybody has a fair shot. I have a record of leadership and integrity and real experience. And I may not be the celebrity candidate, but I am the candidate that's worked in each of these communities for the last 20 years. And I've never embarrassed my constituents. Not once, not for 1 minute, and I never will.
Thank you.
You know, thank you, Errol, Brian, for hosting this and for this lively debate. And Scott, thank you as well. It's always a pleasure. And I mean that very sincerely. This Absolutely. Is what democracy should be all about. This is a campaign that has a fundamental division, a fundamental choice. It's about change versus the status quo. One candidate who was in office for 20 years, who has not left any marks upon public policy. Public doesn't know who he is or what he's done for a reason. He is a product of the establishment, supported by the establishment, an establishment that wants to spend millions of dollars to defeat me. The reason is, yes, because I've stood up for the middle class. I stood up for the middle class in Wall Street. I stood up for the middle class when I fully funded education in the city of New York. I stood up for the middle class when we reformed the healthcare delivery systems here in the city of New York. There's a reason that I'm back and seeking to come back into politics. It's a passion to change. A passion to change a system that right now is not protecting the middle class. A system that has given us in the last few weeks a midtown zoning proposal supported by my opponent that would rush right over the considered views of every municipal group that spoke to it and build huge skyscrapers, which is not what the city needs in that locale. My opponent, who gave the mayor a third term against the wishes of the public, when I said, no, let democracy decide, let the public decide. My career is one of standing up for those who do not have a voice. Undocumented workers, immigrants, low-wage workers, investors on Wall Street, that is what I have done. That is what I will continue to do. This job is not about counting the money. It's to making the money count. That's what I've done. It's what I'll continue to do. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. That is all the time we have for this debate. I'd like to thank the candidates for joining us tonight. And here's a reminder. Primary day is on September 10th. The general election is on November 5th. The next campaign finance board debate will be with the five Democratic candidates for public advocate. That happens this Thursday at 7 p.m. We'll be broadcasting from BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And another reminder, along with these debates, the Campaign Finance Board prints the city's official nonpartisan New York City voter guide. It also produces a video voter guide and has introduced a new mobile platform called nycvotes.org. It makes election and candidate information available right at your fingertips. To learn more, you can visit the board's website, which is www.nyc.cfb.info. Thanks so much for watching and have a great evening.
This has been a special presentation of New York One News and New York One Noticias. A special thanks to the New York City Campaign Finance Board, Citizens Committee for New York City, Citizens Union of the City of New York, Gothamist, Hispanic Federation, Transportation Alternatives, WNYC, CUNY TV, and Time Warner Cable.
Good evening and welcome to the analysis portion of tonight's City Controller debate. I'm Josh Robin, and we are 29 days from the city primaries on September 10th. And for the next 30 minutes, we're going to be talking about that lively back and forth that you just saw between Scott Stringer and Elliot Spitzer. You'll also have the chance to weigh in. I'll tell you how. But first, let's talk about the race for city controller with Eleanor Randolph from the New York Times editorial board, Greg David from Crane's New York Business, and Wayne Barrett, a contributor for WNYC. Now, Eleanor and Greg, it's great to see you two. You'll forgive me. Wayne, it's particularly good to see you. Thanks for coming back. I appreciate it.
I appreciate being here. I found it to be such an odd debate. It's a boxing match in which I think Stringer is swinging.